Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Ah, Thanksgiving. That most American of American holidays. A holiday that harkens back to the founding of our great nation. Yeah, we do have Independence Day on the 4th of July that celebrates our break from Britain. But Thanksgiving, that takes us back deeper in our history, to the time of the Pilgrims, and also tends to be imbued with much more religiosity, even though it is celebrated by many a secular household. Admittedly, this is one of my favorite holidays in large part because of the cooking and the baking that is associated with it. One of my most pleasurable moments every year is coming in from the cold, wet outside to feel the warmth and smell the aroma of the household. In the Gill homestead, we engage in the typical feast with a turkey, cornbread, pumpkin pie, and sweet potatoes that I usually make in a Dutch oven over coals outside. And of course, there is football. God bless America. And as with any holiday, the traditions and customs associated with that day have changed over time, yet seem to have a distinct resonance with the distant past. In our own school system, it is often a time to connect with the past. And throughout the country this week, children will be making handprint turkeys, dressing as pilgrims, and learning about the journey of the Mayflower. But is what they learn always accurate? Does it matter if it is not? Why can't nations dress up their history with myths so as to create a higher standard? Today we take up those questions. Our goal is to understand what went on during the first Thanksgiving, as well as diving into the more meta-theoretical question of how Christians should understand and use history to guide their present understandings and actions. I'm pleased to be joined by one of my former colleagues at the University of Washington, Professor Tracy McKenzie, who is now the chair of the Department of History at Wheaton College. Tracy is renowned as a scholar of the Civil War, writing two books on that topic, which are One South or Many, Plantation Belt and Upcountry in Civil War Era Tennessee, and Lincolnites and Rebels, A Divided Town in the American Civil War. Both of these books explore his home state of Tennessee and are excellent scholarly reads that have a touch of personal history in them. We will link to these books on our website, so please stop by and visit them. Tracy's most recent project, however, takes him back further in our nation's history to understand how historians, Christians, and other citizens understand that most vital tradition that we call Thanksgiving. His scholarship on this topic will be published in the summer of 2013 and is called The First Thanksgiving, What the Real Story Tells Us About Loving God and Learning from History. Tracy, I want to finally welcome you to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Now, listeners will note that I just said, finally, welcome to Research on Religion. Since I've been pursuing Tracy for this show for a couple years, dating back to when he was still at Washington, but he's a real careful scholar, and he didn't want to go on the show until he was pretty much near completion with his Thanksgiving project here. So it is coming out in about 6 or 7 months, correct?
That's the expectation, around the middle of the summer next year.
It's kind of interesting that it's a book on Thanksgiving, and you'd think they'd want to release it in, oh, I don't know, maybe late September, early October, but summertime, is that your choice or anything?
Actually, I think they are hoping that it will be widely available just in time for the holiday, but I guess everything moves slowly in scholarly publishing, so they release it a few months before then.
Well, when it comes out in the summer, we definitely will link to it on our Facebook page again and give everybody reminder to go out and get it, because I've read the transcript from it, some of your notes from it, and it's a really good, exciting book to be looking forward to. I also have to compliment you on the cover, because I happen to be very picky about book covers, and when you sent me some of the initial draft chapters, you showed me the mock-up of the cover of your soon-to-be-published book, and I really, really like it. And I don't say that with all books, but yours I really like. We're going to put a link up on our Facebook page so folks can go take a look-see at that and visit us. It seems to be this classic picture of traditional Thanksgiving feast, the way that our grade school children might envision it and have up on their bulletin boards or something. Did you pick that cover?
Actually, I did not, Tony. The marketing staff at InterVarsity Press, which is the venue where it'll appear, worked on that, and they came up with this illustration on their own. They did so, though, knowing many of the themes of the book and choosing something they thought was appropriate. And I think it is appropriate in that it does evoke that sort of grade school story that so many of us are familiar with. And, of course, that's really what I'm trying to think critically about and carefully about and Christianly about in the context of the book itself.
And that's something that we're going to do throughout this interview. So we're going to visit some of the grade school understandings and some of the more deeper understandings and see how those mesh with one another. I did bring up that painting on the cover because it as you're correct, it does have this image of the typical Thanksgiving and the turkeys there and a very nicely dressed pilgrim leaning over to the Native Americans and all that kind of stuff. But your book has this subtitle that includes the phrase, "The Real Story," which hints that this classic painting might, have a few things wrong with it. And I have to admit, I always get a bit jittery when historians start tossing around the words real history, because I start thinking that we're going down the path of revisionist history, where everything we thought we know was wrong and there's something new, there's some new radical version of events. We turn history completely upside down. And it's oftentimes based upon the values of the present being imposed upon the culture of the past. Is that what is coming from you, the author here? I mean, are you writing revisionist history here?
What a loaded question. I guess I would, on one sense, plead guilty, but on another sense, I would say that the term itself, revisionist history, is redundant, because I actually think all history is revisionist, and it's revisionist because if you think about what history is a sense to engage the past, to make sense of our own time. Part of what that means is situating our own time in the flow of events of human experience across time. And we're going to see that flow of events through the lens of time from our own perspective. What that means is, I think every generation to some degree goes to the past with new questions, new concerns, and often make sense of the past in new ways. Where I sort of take issue with the word of revisionist, it's interesting you ask that, because in the book I begin one chapter with a plea to my readers not to use the term revisionist anymore in discussing history. Part of what I want to drive home in the book is just to make clear that all of us have been guilty of what we call revisionism. And part of what I'm doing in the book is actually to undo some distortions of the past that were promoted by very well-meaning Americans in the 19th century, often Christian Americans.
Mm.
So that is to say that Christians have done their share of revisionism over the years as well. I think the term revisionist itself comes from the 1920s, had a very specific technical meaning when it first began to be used in the English language. It had to do with scholarship, having to do with the origins of World War I. But over time, I think the term revisionist has come to mean, to be very honest, very candid, anyone who remembers the past differently than I do is a revisionist.
Mm-hmm.
If you Google the term revisionist or revisionist history or revisionism, you're going to find that revisionists are everywhere. Christians often see revisionists in the academy. President George W. Bush found revisionists among Democratic critics of the Iraq War. Tea Party supporters smell revisionism among moderate Republicans. Atheists berate Christian revisionists. Liberal bloggers hang the tag on Glenn Beck, and so on and on and on. So it becomes a pretty meaningless term that we use to tar anyone that we disagree with. I also think, because I am writing as a Christian scholar and writing very explicitly, I hope, to Christian readers, I'd like Christians to think about whether the term revisionist, as we use it, is not sometimes a little self-righteous. It's the idea that Other people might use the past or manipulate the past for self-interested motives, but we never would. We're only committed to the unvarnished truth. I think it's a little bit self-justifying. But then finally, it just misses what history really is. I mean, history is a process of perpetually revising our understanding of the past as we try to make sense of ourselves. But having said all that, Tony, I want to stress what I didn't want to do in this book is to write sort of the typical, or what we might think is a stereotypical academic myth-busting work, where all we do is point out how popular understandings are wrong. As a Christian, that's not my motive remotely. What I really believe in thinking about the history of the first Thanksgiving is that if we go back and recapture what I call the real story, we learn actually a great deal, not only about what it means to think historically, but we also, I think, learn from our ancestors in a way that challenges us more than the sort of grade-level understanding that we often cling to so tenaciously. So, yes, revisionist guilty is charged, but I want to redefine really what that means.
Yeah, you do that extremely well in this book, and I brought up the revisionist question because some people are going to be looking at you as the typical academic mythbuster that just wants to shatter typical norms and things like that. But the book, as you read it, it really does challenge Christians to not only think about what went on in Christianity or what went on during the period of the Puritans back in deep colonial American history, but also to think more critically of history in general from a Christian perspective. And that's something that I do want to come back to at the end of the interview. But I know folks are wondering. It's like, okay, you're telling us the real story. Thanksgiving is coming up. Give it to me, right? It's not handprint turkeys and dressing up with a black hat with a little belt buckle on top. So let's go ahead. Let's do this. Let's get into the history of the first Thanksgiving. What happened at this first Thanksgiving?
Well, I'm going to frustrate your question, Tony, I'm afraid, and come back with a complication. Part of what I want us to take seriously is that the term itself, First Thanksgiving, if you take it literally, it can't possibly be an accurate description of what we remember on the Massachusetts coast in 1621. Mm. I say that because no one literally believes that the Pilgrims were the first human beings ever to stop and give thanks to a creator for his bounty. So in no way does even that term apply in a literal sense.
Okay. So it's not the first Thanksgiving. Let's just call it then, I don't know, let's call it the first American Thanksgiving. How's that?
More accurate, but still pretty far from the mark, technically. And that's because, again, I think there's undoubted evidence that any number of Native American cultures practice some sort of religious ritual of giving thanks, particularly for good crops. And so I don't think you can even call it the first American Thanksgiving.
Okay, all right, fine. How about this? Let me try this one out. How about the first Christian American Thanksgiving?
Closer still, but if you go to Florida, one of the things that local historians there will want you to remember was that there was a Spanish presence in North America that significantly predated the Pilgrims, and there is some evidence, at least, of conquistadors celebrating a Thanksgiving Mass as early as 1565, so maybe 56 years before what we remember as, quote, the first Thanksgiving. Texas historians say that there were Spanish Catholics celebrating Thanksgiving with Native Americans in West Texas in the 1590s. So again, it won't even meet the criteria of the first Christian American Thanksgiving.
Okay. So there, yeah, okay. It's not the first Christian one, but there's different types of Christians here. So, you know, I know the Pilgrims were Protestant, so let's call it the first Protestant Christian American Thanksgiving. How's that work?
That would work if not for the fact that there were French Huguenots who migrated to the southeastern coast of the future United States in the 1560s, and there's evidence to suggest that they celebrate a kind of Thanksgiving in the year 1564.
Oh, my God. All right. So what would you call it? If I can't call it the first Thanksgiving, if I can't call it the first American Thanksgiving, the first Christian American Thanksgiving, or even the first Protestant Christian American Thanksgiving, what are we going to call this thing?
So the title that I think would be accurate and will never, ever catch on would be the first American Protestant Christian Thanksgiving north of Virginia but south of Maine.
That would be a really long book title, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be. It would be. The reason that I like to stress that, I mean, I don't get hung up on that, and as a culture, we've decided to call the celebration in 1621 the first Thanksgiving. The reason I stress that is just to remind us that we have chosen as a culture to remember the past in a particular way. I sometimes I've heard it said, you may have as well, that you can't choose your ancestors. Mm-hmm. And in a certain sense, that's true. But when it comes to a national sense, we absolutely do choose our ancestors. One of the way that historians often think of the Pilgrims now is our adopted ancestors. There's the idea that we have consciously chosen them from among any number of possible ancestors of honor. We've chosen them. We've chosen their activities. And we've chosen their Thanksgiving celebration and said, here is the first one. Mm-hmm. And we do that for a reason, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point. And as you call it in your book, the first American Protestant Christian Thanksgiving north of Virginia but south of Maine, it hammers home that point that you're saying, is that, yeah, we can look at the past a little bit differently, a little bit more critically, but still have some reverence for what went on, but also in the same process learn a little bit about how we understand things here in the present and in the past. So, but can we just go ahead and just call it the first Thanksgiving for the rest of the podcast?
I think that would be more convenient.
Okay, it'll save a lot of syllables and probably cut about 20 minutes off the the interview. So let's go ahead and do that. Let's just understand this first Thanksgiving. And give us, before we even get to that celebration, I think it would be 1622 or 1623. 1621, okay, so I'm jumping the gun a little bit. But give us an idea who these Pilgrims were before they hit the coast in 1620. Who were these folks?
Good question. Just to be concise, when we're referring to the Pilgrims, we're referring to a group of English Puritans. We could stop and define that term before we move on. Puritans are English Protestants who are finding it increasingly difficult to follow the Church of England, the Anglican Church, because of a variety of beliefs or practices that they see as still too much influenced or informed by Catholicism. The idea of the term Puritan means this is a movement that believes that English Protestantism has not been sufficiently purified of its Catholic dimension.
Now, did they call themselves that, or was that a name that was imposed upon them?
Puritan is a term that is used at the time. It was, as is often the case of terms that are used, begun really with derogatory connotations by critics, although it's a term that's ultimately, I think, widely used and embraced by all involved. The Pilgrims themselves would have been a subset of English Puritanism that we would define as separatists. If we were to make a distinction, the larger universe of English Puritans objected to certain practices in the Anglican Church, but believed that they could work as a kind of reforming element within the Anglican Church to bring about the desired changes. The separatists had ultimately come to the conclusion that that was not possible. They were a more, if you want to use this term, a more radical subset of English Puritanism. Not only did they think it was not possible, but they had come to the conclusion that the Anglican Church was not an authentic Church of Christ. And with that conclusion, they actually came to the belief that any cooperation, any involvement in the Anglican Church was in itself a sinful act. And so they demanded absolute separation from Anglican fellowship and worship.
Now, what were some of the beliefs or practices that differentiated them? I mean, you would think, well, you know, it's kind of a long historical tradition. Yeah, they might be upset that the Archbishop of Canterbury is picked by the monarch and it's kind of corrupt, but were there any other theological or liturgical practices that they differed on?
Well, in the context of the day, some of the things that they're going to object to have to do mainly with the hierarchy of bishops, the bishopric, which is still part of the church structure of the Anglican Church. They very much object to the idea in the Church of England that one is born into the church by virtue of residence in the English realm. They thought that that created what they called a promiscuous assembly of individuals who were truly regenerate, born again, and those who were not. Those were important distinctions for that time. When we look at the pilgrims from a 21st century perspective, I think there are other things that will jump out at us, things that would probably make some of us at least pretty uncomfortable, even if we ourselves profess a Christian faith. The pilgrims, for example, were absolutely preoccupied with the belief that the Catholic Church had been engaged over the centuries in aggrandizement and constantly expanding its authority and doing so without scriptural warrant. And so one of the things that they are absolutely strict about is insisting on scriptural authority for any kind of practice that they engage in. So some examples. That leads them to be very, very skeptical of church holidays, or holy days, literally, feast days. They believe these are not called for explicitly in Scripture. They can only believe that they are created by the Catholic Church either to expand its influence or simply to give Catholic adherents a kind of justification for a celebration.
Well, I can understand that.
I
can understand that with maybe patron saints days, because I know a lot of Protestant sects kind of give up the idea of saints and stuff, but you're not talking like Christmas and Easter, are you?
Well, exactly. I'm talking precisely about Christmas and Easter. Those are the ones that jump out at us most. They will not celebrate Christmas because they'll say, essentially, show me from Scripture how we know when the birth of Christ occurred. They will not celebrate Easter. They argue, in fact, that every Sunday is a kind of reminder of Christ's resurrection, that there is no indication from Scripture that one particular Sunday is to be elevated to stature above all others. And so they won't celebrate Easter. They won't celebrate Christmas. They really won't celebrate any of the Catholic holidays. And they'll say, for all practical purposes, there is only one regular holy day, and it occurs 52 times a year. They're very, very strict Sabbatarians, but beyond that, they have very little patience for holy days that are regular parts of the calendar.
And I guess one of the great ironies of history, then, is that Thanksgiving is viewed in many ways as an official religious holiday by many Christians.
Well, that is one of the great paradoxes in this story. Yeah, the pilgrims did believe that there could be what they called particular holy days. This would be something that would be called for by the church, not as a regular part of the calendar, but they believed in particular, and they thought that there was scriptural warrant for this, that there could be days of particular humiliation and fasting when, in response to some unusual time of crisis or need, the church would come together as a body, humble itself, and pray for God's deliverance. They also believed that there could be days of thanksgiving. But those ought not to be regular. They shouldn't be prescribed annually. They should only be in response to a very particular, very extraordinary providence of God. And they believed if they became regular, they would become sort of empty rituals.
So what else did they believe that might shock us a little bit today that would be a little bit odd or different?
The one that comes to my mind may seem a little bit trivial, but I don't know about you, Tony, but I was raised in a kind of evangelical culture where we sort of would jokingly say that we knew that Christ read the King James Version of the Bible, that this was the one true edition or translation of the Bible.
Yeah, and we're celebrating the 500-year anniversary
absolutely.
Of the King James
yes,
Bible.
Yes, we are. Yeah. The interesting thing here is that the pilgrims absolutely detested the King James Version.
Wow.
And they detested it because of the particular historical context from which it emerged. As the name of the translation suggests, it is basically commissioned by King James I. And James I is no friend whatsoever of English Puritans, much less, in particular, the English Separatists. And he is actually commissioning that King James translation in part because he is deeply troubled by the more most common translation of the time in English language, which had been created in Geneva in the 1560s. The 1560 Geneva Bible, in fact, had marginal study notes, like we would sort of imagine in a study Bible today, marginal notes that really interpreted certain passages in Scripture to undermine the idea of the divine right of kings.
Mm.
And James wanted nothing to do with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so his translation is going to restore in its editorial annotations some sort of justification for divine right. And so the pilgrims really, it's almost a mark of sort of pride with them and of true zeal. A really zealous Protestant, they would say, wants nothing to do with the King James Bible.
Yeah, that again, we oftentimes associate that with, you know, our great Christian heritage and kind of maybe impose this upon, you know, everybody loved the King James version of the Bible because it's so beautifully written, and it was, you know, the illuminations that were put in there were just absolutely gorgeous as well. But yeah, they didn't want anything to do with that. Anything else stand out about these pilgrims?
Oh, you know, those are the more substantive things. Yeah. There are other things I think is interesting. It just reminds us that so much of what we practice as believers often emerges from particular cultural context.
Yeah.
We come to take it for granted. I like, you know, to use the example that the Pilgrims pastor in Leiden, whose name was John Robinson, who fortunately for us, many of his homilies and sermons have survived. And one of the things he will constantly be saying is that you need to never bow your head while you pray, because that's a way to sort of fall asleep or lose your focus, that the prayer is when one orients ourselves toward God, and it absolutely makes sense to pray with our eyes open and with our heads raised to heaven. So you'll see this various paintings of pilgrims at the time, and they'll often have their hands outstretched, be looking skyward. You know, they take the sovereignty of God more seriously than most Christians that I think do today. And one of the things that really struck home to me, one of the pilgrim writers was a man named Edward Winslow, who was fairly young when the pilgrims relocated in 1620. And Winslow tells in one of his reports back to England about how when the pilgrims would gather for a meal, they would never thank God for the food before they ate, because that was presumptuous, Winslow said. It was presuming that the food would be a blessing, so that they would pray before the meal, asking God to bless the food but not thanking him, and then they would pray after the meal, presumably if they hadn't developed an upset stomach, and they would pray afterwards thanking him.
Mm.
And I just, you know, it just strikes us how very seriously they take what today for us can be such a sort of a pro forma ritual.
Yeah, when I read that in the text too, I thought, yeah, it seems like a little minor thing, but you see these pictures of Winthrop when he lands on Plymouth Rock, or, and he has his arms outstretched and looking upwards. You all say, oh, that's a prayer, right? Yeah, and oh, by the way, yeah, I sit in church every Sunday and I look downwards. You know, in fact, our pastor mm-hmm. tells us, you know, bow your heads.
Right.
And yeah, so that's kind of interesting. Hey, you mentioned a little bit about the one of the reasons they didn't like the King James Bible or King James version of the Bible was because they felt it was trying to restore monarchy. One of the things about the pilgrims that's very interested in our historical context is that we tend to see them as an important part of the story of American democracy. What kind of political views did these pilgrims have?
That's a good question. I think they, in the context of the time, that is to say in the early 17th century in England, they are really quite radically arguing for severe limits on the power of the state in the area of freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. From our perspective today, one of the things that will strike us is that they are still very loyal to the king. And I think they think of themselves as loyal subjects. They think of themselves as English throughout. Their political views are so remote in many respects from our democratic culture today, it's difficult to exaggerate. They think of society hierarchically. They think of society in terms of groups, not individuals. I mean, I think most of us would agree that in America today, the individual is the constituent unit, is the building block of life, not the pilgrims. All individuals live enmeshed, they believe, in one or more overlapping estates, groups. They think in terms of one's situation in family, of one's situation in church, of one's situation in the civil community. And within those three estates, they think of life as hierarchical. Their view of church governance is not democratic. It's not egalitarian. Their view of leadership in the civil sphere is not what we would consider egalitarian. One of the things that I think is very interesting is that they really think of office, political leadership, as a kind of obligation on those with a sort of extraordinary ability or talent. And one of the laws, when the pilgrims set down to codify law for the first time in 1627, one of those laws actually prescribes a very stiff fine for someone who is chosen for office and refuses to accept.
Wow.
In fact, it would have been the equivalent of several years of income. I mean, they basically wanted to make it impossible for someone to decline office. They do restrict voting rights to adult male church members. And then they also prescribe a fine for individuals who don't vote. So it's a kind of misdemeanor in early Plymouth not to vote on an election day.
And that it is kind of interesting because, again, this is one of those things, as I was reading it, you know, we have the image of the settler, the person who's pioneering out there as being the rugged individualist, and that you kind of impose that view upon the pilgrims. And, I mean, I think you're right to point this out, is that, no, that necessarily wasn't the case there.
Yeah, it's not their vision at all. And one of the interesting things, again, in those first laws in 1627, it was illegal for a single adult male to live alone.
Yeah.
If you were not yet married, the colony leadership would assign you a household to live as a part of. They just absolutely thought that isolated individuals sort of adrift on their own were not good at all for the stability and order of the community.
Mm-hmm.
They really felt threatened by it, I think.
Now, one of the things you mentioned earlier, too, is this group of Leiden separatists. And that's one of the things I forgot about. I remember learning about this, but there were actually two different groups of pilgrims. So the ones that went to the Netherlands and settled in Leiden, or Holland, that was called at the same time, and other ones that stayed back in Britain, I think specifically in London. What was the dividing point on these two groups? Were they fairly similar, just one went somewhere else and the other didn't, or what?
That's a good question. It's a little bit difficult to answer. When we think of what we refer to as, quote, the pilgrims, usually we have in mind a group of separatists often associated with a very small fellowship that is located in a little village called Scrooby, which is about 150 miles north of London. It's that group that is sort of the nucleus of those who will migrate from England to Holland in 1607. They're the ones that will be in Leiden, and they'll be the core of the fellowship that will go to what they knew as New England.
Mm-hmm.
Figuring out the numbers is a little bit difficult because so few records survive. We do have a list of the passengers on the Mayflower. It's 102 individuals. It depends on who you check with among historians, but somewhere between a half to two-thirds of those passengers have some connection with that Leiden church. And that Leiden church, according to John Robinson, the pastor there, is probably numbering between 400 and 500 by 1620.
Mm-hmm.
So the individuals who become part of the Voyage of the Mayflower from Leiden, it's actually a quite small fraction of the total number of that congregation. Those pilgrims have to have a benefactor in order to afford the very expensive transatlantic migration to New England. And so they search for various benefactors and are finally able to get in touch with a number of merchants centered primarily in London, that are willing to basically pay for the migration as part of a commercial venture, in which some of the profits from the first 7 years of the venture would return to them. And it's, in fact, the leadership of these merchant adventurers, as they were called in London, that basically connects those Leiden pilgrims with other English individuals who will join them. So when the pilgrims leave Holland in 1620, they go from there to London, and they are joined with a group that William Bradford referred to as the strangers. And he's meaning they're not part of us, they're not part of our fellowship. Some of them undoubtedly were Puritans and more or less sympathetic with the values of the Leiden Fellowship. But a number of those who will join the Mayflower in England really are not going for religious motivations at all. And in fact, William Bradford will see them as, it's almost like tares sown among the wheat, if you remember that gospel parable of Jesus. He sees them as a very negative influence, not sharing the same religious values, the same moral practices at all. So it does become a kind of diverse company. And we tend to forget that latter group because the kinds of sources that have survived about the pilgrims come overwhelmingly from the perspective of the Leiden group.
Yeah, I want to ask a question about that, but I want to hold off on that for a minute because, again, there are, I guess, what you could call some rugged individualists out there to find their fortune in the world that's mixed in with this group, and I'm just wondering if there's going to be tensions. But let's hold off on that for a second. Here's one thing that I've always puzzled at, and you referred to this earlier, that King James, who was the king at the time when the Mayflower set sail, was not a big fan of these separatists. I mean, how, for me, is like, why would he let these folks go to the New World? I mean, they were out in the Netherlands, or Holland, as it was called, and, you know, actually, that was a pretty religiously free place. Nobody bothered them too much. So I guess I have two questions here. Why would those Leiden separatists want to leave Holland? And number two, why would King James let them go?
Both great questions. I'll take them each in turn. The question of the motives of the Leiden Fellowship for Migration is a wonderful one, and it's important that we get that answer right to understand the significance, I think, of the pilgrims. The story, as we tend to tell it, is that the pilgrims came to America in search of religious liberty. I would qualify that significantly. They clearly were uninterested in relocating anywhere where they would not have religious liberty. It was a non-negotiable priority to them. Except we have to also acknowledge that they described their experience in Leiden as the most open, most free environment that they'd ever existed in. Mm-hmm. They have no complaints at all about the situation in Holland with regard to freedom of religion. What is really convincing them that they need to relocate is that they are desperately struggling economically. The economy in Leiden, where they ultimately settle, is a very urban and, for the context of the 17th century, industrial economy. A great deal of production of various kinds of finished cloth is probably the single most important economic venture of the time. And those economic crafts are very much regulated by guilds. Mm-hmm. And the Dutch guilds don't look favorably on admitting foreigners to them. So the migrants from England to Holland find themselves relegated, usually, not always, there are a few exceptions, but usually to very low-paying kinds of piecework. They're living... there have been some very interesting archaeological work done in Leiden to sort of recreate the world of the early 17th century peace workers. They're living in homes that have 200 to 300 square feet to them. They work all day in their dwelling. They eke out a really hard existence. And one of the things that William Bradford is saying is that we're losing our church. And we're losing our church because in sort of like slabs of earth falling away in a stream, gradually more and more individuals are saying, we need to return to England. We can't stay here. We can't take care of ourselves. Even if the adults are able to, their children are leaving. And they're wanting to hold their church together, if at all possible. And so ultimately, this minority of the Leiden congregation says, the way that we're going to stay together as a community is to relocate as a community to a place where we can sustain ourselves economically.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that if you're really wanting to understand why the pilgrims come to America, it is largely out of economic motives.
There was a war brewing at the time, too, wasn't there?
There is a war. Well, yeah. There is the possibility of a war. There had been a peace treaty that had guaranteed peace for a period of time that's going to expire in the early 1620s. And so that's surely in the back of their minds.
Mm-hmm.
Surely in the back of their minds.
Yeah. So why would James the First let him go? Now, I understand part of this was it was a commercial venture, but, you know, the king at the time has a lot of veto power over a lot of these commercial ventures.
Sure. I think the reality is while the London merchant adventurers are going to bankroll what's going on there, they're never able to secure a kind of land grant from James I. That's not what they get from the king. What basically they get is permission to approach what was called at the time the Virginia Company, which was an already existing company that had been chartered by James I originally in 1607. It had gone through a little bit of change of a charter, but it has been in existence for more than a decade when the pilgrims first began to sort of approach James through intermediaries. And the Virginia Company is on the verge of bankruptcy. And in fact, it does go bankrupt and is shut down by the king in 1624. And so the Virginia Company desperately would like to have more settlers because they see that as essential to their financial viability. And so what James is really approving is simply for the pilgrims to go and be part of that Virginia experiment.
It just needs warm bodies out there.
Essentially.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, if you have them across the Atlantic Ocean, too, they're not making noises back home.
They aren't. And it's very interesting. I talk about this in the book. The pilgrims basically write a letter through an intermediary in which they try to assure James that they will be faithful to the both to his prerogative and to the rule of the Anglican Church. And in both of those instances, they really are masters at parsing words to appear to be more compliant than they really are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. James the First has to be looking at it and says, yeah, I know you're paying loyalty to me, but if you were really loyal, you would be members of the Anglican Church and not complaining about it, but you're complaining about it. So why don't you go over there to Virginia and just get out of my hair for a while?
Right.
Yeah. So let's get on board the ship. Let's take the ship over, and you can see on the History Channel or different places they have, you know, in images of, actually, you kind of laugh because one of the things I loved about your book is that you mentioned the History Channel no longer does history.
Right.
Yeah, that drives me crazy, too. It's, you know, the ice road truckers all day. I'm not sure how that works. But anyways, we know the journey across was hard and difficult, but let's go ahead and land. They didn't quite get to Virginia. They end up in Cape Cod, and there they are. I want to now understand what their life was in this first year. And I want to take it back to that question we mentioned earlier, was that not everybody was one of these Puritan pilgrims that came over there. You got, you know, the Captain Jones was there and his crew, and they're not necessarily the pilgrimy type. And there's a few others there, the strangers. How did they all get along when they settled there?
Great question. They probably didn't get along perfectly. There was concern about that even before they land, and the reality is one of the things that we remember the pilgrims most for is very much rooted to concerns about how those two groups would get along once they land, and that's the Mayflower Compact. The Mayflower Compact is signed aboard a ship before they actually identify a permanent settlement site, and that compact essentially says that we're going to bind ourselves together as a civil body and basically submit to a collective government. And we tend to remember that, or at least it has been remembered, particularly since the mid-19th century is really sort of the first major democratic expression in the roots of the United States. But surely one part of the motivation for creating that compact was the fact that the Pilgrims had picked up on grumblings and mumblings among the strangers that once they landed, particularly when it was evident that they had been blown off course and were going to be several hundred miles north of the northernmost area claimed by the Virginia Company, that once they landed, they were going to do absolutely whatever served their own interests and had no intention of cooperating. And in fact, both Edward Winslow and William Bradford are quite explicit about this in their various writings, that they wanted basically to demand some sort of willingness to submit to a collective rule, to the decision of the community before they would allow them to land.
Right, right. Yeah, otherwise you're just going to end up killing one another. It is interesting, and you noted this, and I hadn't really thought about this. I know they got blown off course, and okay, they're a little bit farther north, but there's a little interesting political twist to this, is because if they would have landed in Virginia, then they were required to obey the laws and agreements of the Virginia Company, but they were outside the boundaries, so all the rules have to be rewritten here.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, so they really, in a certain sense, are on their own, and that's both an opportunity and it's also a little bit of a danger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it's in that context that we see the Mayflower Compact created.
What did this Mayflower Compact do, and what did their political and economic life look for the first year or two?
Well, the compact is basically just a statement that they are going to create themselves or think of themselves as a kind of civil community, and that they each are going to submit themselves as individuals to this larger community and to its governance. Whether that has a kind of practical effect, it's hard to say for the first few years. It's probably not likely, we're not absolutely certain, but it was probably several years before anything that looked like an election actually takes place. What really is governing the sort of daily framework of life is an agreement that the Leiden congregation had entered into with the merchant adventurers, a kind of contract that they'd entered into long before the voyage. And under this contract, they had agreed effectively to work for that company for 7 years. And under the terms of that agreement, they were to labor in common.
Mm-hmm.
All property would be held in common. The physical structures that they would erect would actually be held in common. All the harvest would be held in common. From that common produce, they would feed themselves, and then they would give to the merchant ventures half of everything above what was necessary for subsistence for the next 7 years. So that's the understanding that pretty much frames their existence as a community at the outset.
Now, I would think, being that they're a pretty similar group, they share the same religion, there's not that many of them, that must have worked out pretty well.
Well, it doesn't work out actually very, very well at all. Now, it doesn't work out in that first year for reasons that were extraordinary and probably very difficult to avoid. Landing in November and actually settling on a site in December of 1620, they're right at the beginning of a pretty severe Massachusetts winter. And I think most people know this part of the story, that they're short on food, they're exposed to the elements, and they die in enormous numbers, with right at one half of the colony dying in that first winter. But from that point, let's say from the summer of 1621 on, they've really survived that first really severe adjustment to the new situation. But at that point, there is more and more grumbling and complaining, evidently from a number of quarters, about the system. That is to say, this collective system in which all is shared similarly. It seems to take away a lot of motivation for hard work individually. Families that have more adult children or have more women who are contributing are troubled by the fact that their wives, for example, seem to be really working not only just for them but for the single men. There's just a lot of room for complaint, and it's actually exacerbated in the fact that the merchant ventures are continuing to send new groups of individuals that the Leiden Fellowship don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's actually quite a bit of complaining, and it culminates 2 years into their venture in 1623 in the spring, when a group goes to William Bradford, who by this time is the governor, and they ask him to do something which is essentially to unilaterally break their agreement with the merchant ventures. What they ask for is that let's dispense with holding everything in common, let's divide up the land into family plots, and let everyone sort of work their own land. And Bradford ultimately decides to do that. And from 1623 on, that's the new standard. And at least by his account, it works significantly better from that point.
There is something really interesting that I did not know that I learned from your book. I kind of knew that story about the communal farming didn't work out too well. But the second thing that they did once they privatized the plots of land, they decided to randomly reallocate them every year.
Originally that was what they went to. It wasn't that everyone would have ownership, sort of vested permanent ownership in a plot, but they would have a plot, and they would get the produce of their particular plot. And then people come back to Bradford after 1623, and they say, "Oh, this was an improvement, but we still have no incentive to work on long-term kinds of improvements to our land, because anything that we do to increase its long-term productivity is going to be reaped by someone else."
Yeah.
And so ultimately they do move to permanently allocating land.
One of the other stories that, beyond the how they allocated land and the incentives that provided for growing food, one of the other stories that's talked about quite a bit was relations with the Native Americans. And this always comes into play in the Thanksgiving pageants that the kids have, that pilgrims, "Oh, we don't know how to grow food. We need help. There are people who've been living here for a long time. They know the land and know how to grow food, and they show you how to plant corn with dead fish." And I remember these stories mm-hmm. from third grade. How were the relations with the natives, and how did that work into their ability to improve their agricultural output?
Well, here's an example of where the familiar story has a sort of an element of truth and element of myth, I guess. It is the case that the pilgrim surely benefits from relations with the most immediate Native American neighbors, which was a group known as the Wampanoag. They not only are trading with them, but one individual, this is the part of the story we all learn in grade school, a Indian named Tisquantum, or nicknamed Squanto, is helping in some ways to introduce the pilgrims to some indigenous agricultural practices. So that much is clearly true. But when we think about the relation between the pilgrims and the Wampanoag, it's not remotely the kind of warm and fuzzy story that we tend to remember.
Mm.
That area of New England had been devastated by one or more major epidemics in the period of the early 17th century, probably because of interaction with various European fishing vessels before this. Viral hepatitis maybe was the most virulent. An enormous percentage of Native American population dies as a result of these multiple epidemics. And the Wampanoag had been badly, badly decimated. One of the sort of ironies or peculiarities of the story, however, is if you go just about 50, 60 miles away toward Rhode Island, one of their largest rivals and bitter enemies was the Massachusetts Indians, and they had been spared most of the costs of the epidemic. So the Wampanoag find themselves in a vastly weakened state, not only just in an absolute sense, but in the relation with their bitterest enemies. And so when the Pilgrims arrive right at the end of that period of epidemic, the Wampanoag are looking for a way to increase their leverage relative to the Massachusetts Indians.
Yeah, and an ally.
And they see the Pilgrims as a potential ally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a much more complicated story than we tend to tell. And certainly the Wampanoag are helping the Pilgrims for largely self-interested reasons. The Pilgrims need the Wampanoag, but never trust them. It's not the story that we learn in grade school.
So that gets me to the cover of your book now. So we got the Pilgrims having a hard time, rough winter, and adjusting the communal agriculture and shifting that around. You got the story of the Native Americans here, but you look on the cover of your book, which again will be on our Facebook page for folks who want to visit there and like us and see that what that cover is like. It's just this beautiful, friendly thing that's going on here, that feast, the Thanksgiving feast. Where does this Thanksgiving feast come into, and how is it captured by our American imagination?
Well, the celebration that is going to take place in sometime, we don't know when exactly, sometime after the harvest in 1621, by all appearances, seems to be reproducing a kind of practice that would have been fairly common in England, in rural areas in England, that was called the Festival of Harvest Home, a kind of festival of the ingathering of the harvest. And the Pilgrims are reproducing that. There are numerous elements of the way that we remember that story, though, for which there's very little evidence whatsoever. I hate to start with it, but there's actually no evidence that there was turkey on the menu. At the first Thanksgiving.
Well, did they at least watch the Packers play the Lions?
they probably did have some physical activity,
right.
If that is a comfort to you at all.
Yeah.
Bradford, in his account, not at the first Thanksgiving, one of the things that I stress in the book is the total amount of description of what we call the first Thanksgiving amounts to 115 words. Bradford himself never even referred to it. It's Edward Winslow that mentions it in a letter. Bradford does say that they had a good harvest. He said that they had plenty to make it through the winter. And he talks about the sky being almost literally darkened with waterfowl at that time of the year. And so it's probably more likely, if we're thinking about menu, they would have had geese and swans and ducks, not much in the way of turkeys. One of the things, if you look at that picture for the book cover, not only will you see the Wampanoag looking like Plains Indians from the Midwest in the 19th century, but it's also not at all clear from any of the evidence that survives that the Wampanoag were even invited.
Mm.
We know from several other instances, both from Edward Winslow and William Bradford, that the Wampanoag often had come by without being invited. So much so that in the summer of 1621, Bradford, as governor, sends Winslow and a couple of other of the adult males as a delegation to Massasoit, who was the chief, centrally, of the Wampanoag, and basically asks him not to come anymore, expecting to be invited for dinner, is what it boils down to. That they really are living on the margin, and they can't feed them. And it's interesting what Winslow says in his account of the first Thanksgiving. If he uses the passive voice, he says, the Indians coming among us. And I think that's suggestive. He doesn't say we invited them. He says the Indians came among us. The one other thing I would say from the picture is, if the numbers that we have in the sources are true, there were probably twice as many Indians as there were Pilgrims at the gathering. And that rarely gets captured in these portrayals.
Hmm. So, again, that tells me the story of what happened there. But one of the interesting things that you note in the book is that this is a history that isn't told in the later 1600s, even in the early 1700s. It only becomes an issue in the 1790s that we start to hearken back to the Pilgrims and to the Mayflower Compact. Why is that?
It's a good question. I sort of liken back to the famous conundrum, if a tree falls in a forest and nobody's there to hear it, would it make a sound?
Mm-hmm.
The only account of the what we call the first Thanksgiving was in this letter that I referred to that Edward Winslow sends to England in 1622. It gets published as part of a sort of a pamphlet shortly thereafter, with a very long name title that I won't go into. But this pamphlet basically is published in a very small circulation. Most of the copies are lost, and for all practical purposes, this is not remembered. It's not remembered for more than a century and a half. Even in the 1790s, when Americans are beginning to think back to the Pilgrims, they're not really thinking of the first Thanksgiving. The term pilgrim itself is first used, that, as far as we know, to describe this group in the 1790s. But they're being remembered for the landing, particularly the landing at Plymouth Rock, and that's a story in itself because there's no reference to Plymouth Rock in any of the pilgrim documents. Mm. But they're being remembered for the landing, and they're being remembered for the Mayflower Compact. They're not being remembered for the, quote, so-called First Thanksgiving. That actually takes place in the 1840s.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1840s, there is a New England congregational minister who's sort of an amateur historian who actually comes across a copy of this report by Edward Winslow that had ended up in a library in New England, and he transcribes it and includes it in a collection that he's doing of documents from what he calls the Pilgrim Fathers. And when he recounts Winslow's description of the 1621 celebration in a footnote, and it's only in a footnote, he says, here Winslow is describing what we remember as the first New England Thanksgiving.
Hmm.
So that's 1841, that's 220 years after the event. And most of our cultural memory of this event then starts. That's really when it begins.
And it doesn't become a national holiday. And I should know this because it's in my lifetime, but I just never really realized it. It doesn't become a national holiday until, what, 1970 or 71?
It's going to be regularly acknowledged as a national holiday on a yearly basis, starting, it actually begins with Abraham Lincoln, and that the presidents will declare it as a national holiday, but Congress will not define it as a national holiday. Actually, it's going to be defined during Franklin Roosevelt's term.
Okay.
It may be followed up later in the early 1970s, but there is Congress gets involved in a way that it had never before in the late 1940s, and it has to do with FDR trying to move the date of Thanksgiving on his own authority.
Hmm.
And that creates a stir. It then is finally settled, I think, in the 1970s. But the interesting thing to me as a historian is that when the memory of the first Thanksgiving is really brought to the attention of the American people in the 1840s, it has no effect whatsoever.
Hmm.
And I think there are a number of reasons why that is so. I think one reason why that is so, and these aren't mutually exclusive reasons, but I think one of them has to do with the fact that when the story is told, the Native Americans play such an important part of that celebration.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, in 1841, when this minister discovers this reference, this is only, it's 3 years after what we remember as the Trail of Tears, of mm-hmm. the removal of the Cherokee Indian from the southeastern part of the United States. White Americans have largely been supportive of pushing Native American presence to the West. This is a story about a chapter in America's founding in which there appears to be a fairly harmonious relationship and at least cooperation out of self-interest mm-hmm. between Native Americans and whites. And that's not the way Americans are thinking of the national story in the 1840s. Something else that I think is a factor here is that in the 1840s, we're right on the cusp of the political crisis, sectional political crisis, that is going to unfold and ultimately culminate in civil war. And the story that we know of the first Thanksgiving, when it's first rediscovered, it is embraced immediately by New England. And almost immediately, it becomes to be perceived by the rest of the country as a Yankee story and a Yankee holiday.
Mm.
And so you read all kinds of accounts in Southern newspapers. They want nothing to do with Thanksgiving. And it's just this celebration that those self-righteous, pharisaical New Englanders celebrate, and we want nothing of it. And remember that the Pilgrims didn't celebrate Christmas. Right. So Southerners, for example, often emphasize that Christmas is the Southern holiday, Thanksgiving is the Yankee holiday. So I think that's part of it. And then just the final thing is that Americans had been celebrating Thanksgiving before 1840. They just didn't associate it or think of it as a tradition that they had inherited from the Pilgrims. In the 1840s, when they discover this, they have come to celebrate Thanksgiving as a very private, inward-focused, family-centered holiday, pretty much as we might think of it today. But if you read Edward Winslow's account of the first Thanksgiving, it is a public event. It is an outdoor event. And it probably is much more like what we would associate with, say, a 4th of July town celebration than with the very family-centered, home-centered celebration that we associate with Thanksgiving. So the way the Pilgrims thought of Thanksgiving was not the way that Americans did. And so a lot of these things have to change, or time has to pass, before Americans can sort of make peace with the first Thanksgiving and really embrace it.
Well, in the minutes that we have left here, and there are so many other things in your book that you make my eyes pop open, and you sit there and you say, oh, wow, that's kind of interesting. And I'm going to refer people back to your book. I know it doesn't come out until the summer of next year, but we'll make sure that we link up to it when it does come out. But the question I do want to leave off with is your reflection as a historian and as a Christian and also as a father. Because you have kids, I have kids, and you know, part of the whole second grade and third grade Thanksgiving pageant is building this myth about what high standards or what it means to be an American and the high standards that we have. And, you know, as we talked about, some of this is looking through a prism that, you know, is distorting history in the past. How, as a historian, do you deal with that issue? And how, as Christians, do we understand our history in a way that maintains those high standards but also really reflects what went on?
Right. It's a great question. I'll try to be brief. I think one of the things I want to emphasize in the book is that as Christians, we have a great deal to learn from the Pilgrims. Have no qualms about saying I admire much of what they stood for and much of how they lived out their faith. What I would say is that almost all that gets obscured by the stories we tell about them. We've transferred the Pilgrims largely into modern Americans so that we think of them just like our neighbors, maybe dressed a little oddly, but otherwise just like us. In the reality, there's much of what they believe that should challenge us deeply. I think they valued the common good in a way that perhaps we chafe against. They took the sovereignty of God seriously in a way that probably most of us do not. They believed in the most substantive way that their daily survival existed or depended upon the intervention of God. And so, you know, with my kids, we wanted our kids to admire the Pilgrims. In fact, they would dress up a couple of times. They dressed up at the fall for fall festivals as little pilgrim girls, or my son was William Bradford, and so forth. But we like to tell them other parts of the Pilgrim story. One part that we haven't touched upon at all is that when the Pilgrims really celebrated what they considered a Thanksgiving holy day, as opposed to a celebration of the harvest, was actually 2 years later in 1623. They had a major drought in the summer. Their crops were withering. Their corn crop was withering in the field. They're facing starvation full on if something doesn't happen. They declare a day of humiliation and fasting. They meet and they pray in their meeting house for 8, 9, 10 hours. And Edward Winslow says that when the day had begun, it was a cloudless sky, hot and dry. By the time that they had ceased praying, the sky was clouded over. By the time of the evening, a soft, gentle rain had begun to fall that lasted for 2 weeks. And so with what they saw as absolutely God's answer to their prayer, they then call for a particular day of thanksgiving. They would have called it a particular day to respond to God's extraordinary answer to their prayer. So one of the things I've thought, I wish when my kids were very small that I'd been on top of this more, but, you know, as families, I think it's absolutely fine for us to celebrate the last Thursday and in November, celebrate it, enjoy that family time. But what I wished I had done more as a father was to share with my children when we had particular, you know, challenges as a family, and to pray together with my children as a family. And then when we see God's answer to that prayer, you know, milk it for all it's worth. If you're the father, the parents think of yourselves as the governors of the family, issue a proclamation. You know, we're going to have a celebration. We're going to have a Thanksgiving for God's goodness, and point them to that and say, here was our particular need. Here was God's very specific provision, and we are going to celebrate. And I think that's building on the pilgrim's example in a way that, no offense, gathering together for turkey and TV, football on TV, doesn't exactly capture.
That's a really great point, too. Again, that Thanksgiving is not just that last Thursday of November, but it is a day that we give thanks all year round in many particular points in time, but, you know, hopefully every day for God's graces. So, yeah. Tracy, this has been a wonderful discussion, and I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot about it. We will remind folks again when your book comes out in the summertime. But until then, I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving, and thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much, Tony. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.